Hi everybody, welcome to yet another scintillating podcast situation. I'm Craig Eastman, always coming to you from just outside Liverpool, and in Glasgow as always is Scott Morris.
Howdy.
And in Falkirk, as always, would be Mr. Drew Tavendale.
Hola.
Yeah, we're going to be covering a fair bit of ground today, with any luck, taking in certain sites along the way, and those would be Son of Rambo, in Bruges, Leatherheads, Iron Man, Happy-Go-Lucky, Doomsday, and Persepolis. Hopefully we'll get all those crammed in for your listening pleasure or displeasure, delete as applicable. So without further ado, let's get on and ramble some shit. How's everybody been doing of late? Scott?
Super awesome.
Any particular reason you've been super awesome?
Because it's May.
Excellent. It doesn't get any better than that. Drew, how have you been?
Five, maybe six.
You can't really complain at that, can you? You just get on with it. What's first up for discussion, lads? What would you like to mention first?
Don't know. You pick one. Surprise me.
Surprise you. All right, without further ado, we're going to get on, and I pick completely at random Leatherheads, which would be George Clooney's latest directorial offering. One of you guys want to sum that shit up?
Difficult to believe in these times of multi-million dollar endorsements and never-ending cavalcade of cheerleaders, but there was a time when professional American football was the equivalent of a Sunday league pub football tournament. But back in the 20s, it was certainly the red-headed stepchild of college football. College football being the big deal, and the biggest deal of them all is the clean-cut Carter Rutherford, played by John Krasinski. He's a top player and a World War I hero, a man whom an entire platoon of Krauts surrendered to due to his sheer American wholesomeness, or so the story goes. Meanwhile, in Duluth, the Bulldogs and their quarterback Jimmy Dodge Connolly, played by George Clooney, also directing, they're on the verge of bankruptcy, but Dodge comes up with a last-ditch gamble, convincing Carter to put his prospective law career on hold and go professional, thus reviving interest in the pro leagues and making everyone a lot of money. As it turns out, this all goes swimmingly, which isn't particularly dramatic, so we need a bone of contention. That bone's provided by reporter Lexi Littleton, played by Renee Zellweger, sadly, assigned to cover Carter before writing a hatchet job on his war career. An unexpected side effect of this is that both Dodge and Carter fall for her, for some reason not immediately obvious to mortal man, and the two wind up becoming, if not mortal enemies, at least reflections of different eras that can't coexist with each other. The new focus on the professional part of professional football, not allowing for Dodge's trademarked pig in a poke and crusty bobs, whatever they are. What's the point of it all? Damned if I know. It is, however, a relatively pleasing way to spend a couple of hours with much the same feel to it as, say, Down to Love. Clooney's never less than affable in this sort of thing, and I'm starting to get the feeling that he might have been a bit more comfortable in this era. Zellweger's less irritating than usual, and John Krasinski does well enough. It's consistently mildly amusing, and I get the impression that's about all it was aiming for. It's a decent enough film, and it's probably better than a good percentage of the film I've seen this year, but I'm struggling to be wildly enthusiastic about it.
It's interesting to say there that about Clooney looking like he'd feel more comfortable in that sort of an era, because he does seem to fancy himself as a bit of a Saturday matinee idol, doesn't he? He wishes he was Cary Grant, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not, and he should be glad, because Cary Grant's dead.
Yes. Good point, well made.
Psych. So, safe to say then that not overly impressed by Leatherheads, but at the same time not entirely offended by it.
Yeah, well, it's nothing to shout about, but I mean, it's quite funny, it's entertaining enough. I mean, if you just want something that's going to amuse you for a bit, not cause you to have to think about any issues, but not like waste your time either, then it's certainly very enjoyable. And Renee Zellweger, considerably less irritating in this than she generally is. And you know, something of a real chemistry between her and George Clooney, and it's not as saccharine so many of these romantic comedies are.
I was going to ask you about the chemistry, actually, because I've heard sort of varying reports as to how well they smoulder or otherwise on screen together. Scott, what did you reckon?
To be honest, there's not really that much of an attraction that I can see. It's just, I don't know, it's perfunctory more than anything else. It's
so not on the same level as Clooney and Jennifer Lopez in Out of Sight, which was a bit steamy at times.
No, nothing near enough. And I suppose there shouldn't be, because it wouldn't have fit in with that time and that era. But it's enough to keep you interested and keep rolling along. And I suppose it does what it needs to do. But it doesn't do anything more than that.
Yeah, it was met by very middling reviews when it came out, didn't it? But a lot of people seem to be saying it's crap just off the back of the fact it didn't do particularly well. It was before we knew how it was going to perform, they were sort of saying, yeah, it's all right, it'll probably do reasonably well. And then when it didn't do well, sort of opinion seems to have turned to, ah, it's crap.
Yeah.
Seems a little unfair.
It is a little unfair, but again, it's not good enough of a film for me to actually warrant going and sticking up for it. It's judged on its own merit, it's okay, and that's about it.
So mostly disposable trash then?
Yes.
Ah, well, fair enough. And why shouldn't it be, I ask you? First of two British movies that we're going to get a chance to look at this week, hopefully be Son of Rambo, which has been garnering far more positive reviews than George Clooney's latest, certainly. One of you guys want to fill us in on that one?
A perhaps unexpectedly lovely little romp through childhood sees Will Proudfoot, played by a young Bill Milner, who's brought up in the strictly religious household of the 12th Pentecostal Luddite Wingbats. He's a good kid, but clearly the lack of 80s action films is causing a grievous imbalance in his life. Lee Carter, played by Will Poulter, is not a good kid, being the local equivalent of Dennis the Menace. A chance meeting leads to Lee Carter taking something of an advantage over the young lad, and the two become what's at least somewhere in the vicinity of friends. After being exposed to Stallone's original Rambo, Will takes something of a fancy to it, working up an involved fantasy in which he, the son of Rambo, undertakes a mission to find his father, Will's real-life dad having died sometime prior to this. Borrowing a video camera from Carter's petulant elder brother, the lads decide to make their own movie, the two misfits eventually aided and abetted by the rest of the school, including a bizarrely popular French exchange student. I dread to use the word whimsical because it automatically makes things sound a little bit pony, but here the term fits quite well.
There's nothing wrong with whimsical.
Or if not whimsical, at least surreal does quite well, the school seeming to be based on a distorted Knobs to 11 distilled memory of what the writer's school days were like that has very little in common with reality. Reality, however, is boring and rarely allows for kite-flown plastic dogs to startle Adam Buxton and make him jam scissors up his nose. Son of Rambo is a charming little treat that not only bounces between gently amusing and downright hysterical, but also manages to be touching without devolving into sappy sentimentality. It's definitely one that you should invest a little time in.
Excellent stuff. I wouldn't mind catching up with Son of Rambo, actually. It's had very positive reviews. Seems to be a British film to be proud of. Not a lot of those kicking about at the moment. Perhaps the most interesting thing about Son of Rambo, superficially, would be the fact that they've been forced to spell Rambo differently in order to avoid tarnishing the Rambo franchise, which you can't help but think that if Stallone was that worried about tarnishing the Rambo franchise, he wouldn't have recently made Rambo.
Well, to be honest, the connection never occurred to me. So cunning and well-planned was the change of name that I didn't actually connect it with Rambo at all.
Ah, there you go. Great bit of camouflage there. From one fairly decent film with British people in it to another fairly decent film with British people in it. In Bruges, from director Martin McDonagh, has been receiving sort of reasonable reviews, and I think it's probably going to receive the same from our crack review team. It stars Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson as hitmen who are laying low in Bruges for the meantime, whilst their sadistic boss, Ralph Fiennes, yes, that's sadistic boss Ralph Fiennes, decides what to do with them, basically. Guys, what's the dealio with in Bruges? Is it as boring as that city is made out to be, or is it far more interesting?
It's a good deal more interesting. And
I like to hear it.
About as politically correct as Bernard Manning, but quite a lot funnier.
Excellent.
Well, as you say, Hitman Ray, Colin Farrell and Ken, Brendan Gleeson, are sent to Bruges to hide out, and while Ken's happy soaking in the medieval atmosphere of the well-preserved historical spot, Ray's far less happy with the locale. However, things take a slight turn for the better for Ray once he stumbles across Chloe, played by Clements Posey, a pretty young thing flogging narcotics to a visiting film production. Despite some initial faux pas, such as laying out two fellow diners on their first date, it seems that Ray may not have entirely wasted his time in Belgium. And once you throw in a couple of manky hookers and Jordan Prentice as Jimmy the racist horse tranquilizer adult dwarf actor, and you've got all the ingredients for a screwball underworld comedy.
Toho!
The only asparagus in the mix comes from Hitman's boss, Harry, Ralph Fiennes, how pretentious, Ralph Fiennes, revealing the real reason that the pair have been sent abroad, setting in motion a rather unfortunate and bloody chain of events that I shall thankfully leave unspoiled for you. After setting itself up as more or less a comic outing of questionable taste and ethics, it starts trying to graft a thriller onto the back of it, and at the same time it's still trying to be funny, as evidenced by Fiennes' continual scenery chewing that plays like a hybrid of the Kray twins and the Chuckle Brothers. as such, its dramatic impact's a little bit undermined. It might have been better sticking with the comedy, because that's really what it's doing best. Farrell and Gleeson are excellent, and the banter between the two seems natural. It's flows well. It's very amusing. The supporting tons are all strong. If there's any awards being given out for high quality facial expressions in film, then these two have to be in the running. And it's about as good a black comedy I've seen in pretty much my entire life. If you're as sick, twisted and irreverent as the human race generally proves itself to be every day, I think you'll love In Bruges, because I know I certainly did.
Drew, would you like to expand on that?
There's not really much to expand on. It's just, it's blackly comic, deeply funny, incredibly inappropriately brilliant, and it's just highly recommended. There's nothing really I could add to that.
Is it this decade's Gross Point Blank?
Possibly. It's probably in a lot worse taste than Gross Point Blank.
Yeah.
But it is very good and a very similar theme. I was comparing it to Orphans, a film by Joel Mullen. A film by Peter Mullen, which is...
Oh, a.k.a. Joe.
Well, his name was Joe.
indeed it was, yes.
So it is as good a film as I've seen that deals with something so black, and it's odd. It's a kind of film that I felt kind of guilty for laughing at some of the things that I was laughing at, but that just made it funnier for some reason. If you're very straight-laced, then you'll hate this film with a passion, but if you're a moral cesspool like I am, then it's fantastic.
There's a slight shimmer of shame at laughing at some of the jokes, but you know, it's generally just that shimmer's just wiped out by just how bloody funny it is.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Very good film.
Feel a bit dirty about some of the jokes, feeling them funny, but it is excellent.
Unfortunately, another film starring British people which managed to annoy me purely on the basis of all the sound bites I've heard from it would be Happy Go Lucky. I don't even want to approach this film because it seems to be courting this sort of debate over whether you're the kind of person who will A, warm to the lead character, or B, be unable to see past her completely annoying demeanour. And I have to tell you, I can guarantee you now, with 199% accuracy, that I would be one of the latter. Which one of you guys is going to expand on Happy Go Lucky?
I'll do it if I must.
Yes, you must.
Mike Lee, doing a film that isn't about unalloyed misery.
What?
Who'd have thought it would ever happen? And
not on my watch.
Now that has happened, I kind of wish that it didn't. Poppy, played by Sally Hawkins, is an unbearably upbeat, chirpy, chipper, and wouldn't you know it, happy-go-lucky denizen of Old Land End Town, a town generally known more for the manifold opportunities for unalloyed misery it provides. We join her life just as she's had her bike stolen, an occurrence that's only effect on her appears to be a passing regret that she was not able to say goodbye to it. Because she's a loon. Unbelievably enough, in a film full of unbelievably, she's a teacher, and at a push you could say this film's about teaching. Her own career, obviously. Her flatmate's also a teacher. There's run-ins with an over-emotional flamenco teacher, and the bulk of the drama comes from her crazy driving instructor. Although, even then, it's not a film about teachers as much as a film with a lot of teachers in it. Instead, it's a character piece about Poppy, which isn't a terrible idea in theory, except when the character is so teeth-grindingly irritating that hammering nails into your ear suddenly seems like a comparatively tremendous idea. The woman's voice appears to have been supplied by Philip Glass with much the same results. Her relentless, stupid-faced optimism and constant mindless withering never comes close to sounding like someone who's genuinely happy, or perhaps it's just that Mike Lee himself has immersed himself in misery for so long that he doesn't know how to write happy, and have it come across as even close to realistic anymore.
Yeah.
This continual level of chirpiness and airheaded asides, even during serious moments, can only be explained by mental illness or off-camera drug abuse. It's one of those select group of films that you could wish you could just reach through the screen and grab this woman by the shoulders and just beg her to just stop talking.
There's an interesting thread on IMDb here. Most annoying film character ever.
Yes, I will heartily sign up to that fact.
Yes, I would say there's pretty much no competition for that.
I quote 1975 JP... I found the character of Poppy so excruciatingly annoying. I longed for someone to slap her very hard around her stupid, smiling face. Anyone else? Yes. Does that just about sum it up?
That's quite succinct and quite true.
On the basis of around about a grand total of about 2 minutes of clips which I've picked up on the radio from the film has utterly put me off. I cannot stand that performance. Having not seen it, I can tell you I cannot stand that performance. Sally Hawkins is immediately blacklisted as far as I'm concerned.
And having seen it, I can tell you you're 100% correct in feeling that way.
How does Eddie Marson come across? Because he's normally quite reliable and he sort of pops up in a lot of British films and sort of minor roles, and everybody says, oh, isn't he great? But this whole thing about remembering your mirrors by some sort of Egyptian chant or something, what's all about? It's doing my head in already.
No, I mean, I don't like Eddie Marston, but it's only ever bearable when he's on screen.
Yeah.
But even then, he's just saddled with such a silly role where he's playing such a ludicrously over-the-top, it's not conspiracy theory, but he has some very strange ideas about the world and how it works. But
yeah,
you can't do anything with it.
And the only reason it's bearable, it's not even that it's... You can't really say his performance is good because it's just such a silly thing he has to do. It's just because his craziness is some slight relief from the unbearable Sally Hawkins.
Oh. Does she not redeem herself at any point when it comes to, you know...
At no point does she explode. That's the only way she could redeem herself in my
eyes. By the end of the film, she's still alive. Therefore, she has not redeemed herself.
Nice.
Scott said there, and he stole what I was going to say, I'm surprised we could discuss this. She is, in a former previous podcast, we talked about how awful Philip Glass's music was in Notes on a Scandal, and she is like the character version of that music.
Yeah.
I wanted to stick my fingers in my eyes to make her go away. it's just, the film should be called a case study in being irritating. And I've seen quite a few reviews in professional publications that have said, yes, it's wonderfully upbeat. She's a standout character. These people are wrong and dangerous.
What they mean is she's a wildly unrealistic character.
It's a very strange wardrobe she has too. She apparently thinks she's shopping in thrift stores in about 1982. And it took me quite a long time to decide it was actually contemporary London it was supposed to be set in. I have a theory too. That people have been pestering Mike Leigh to make an upbeat film for so long, he's finally given in to the pressure, but has said it's pretty much a fuck you to the people pressuring him to do it by saying, right, you asked me for an upbeat film, this is what you get. If you ask me for an upbeat film, can I go back to Misery now, please? Stop pestering me.
I was going to say, I like him when he's doing Misery, but I have to say that I've been completely put off seeing this film purely on the strength of Sally Hawkins' performance. Mm. Which surely can't be a good thing. Yeah.
I mean, there's a kernel of an interesting story in there somewhere, but it's so comprehensively overwhelmed by this brain-itchingly annoying central character that the film just becomes an absolute dreadful nightmare. It's a horrible, horrible film, and I can imagine it being one of the worst films I'll see this year, possibly the worst film I'll see this year, because it is just so, so annoying.
Nice one. Take that. Sally Hawkins had it coming. The first of this summer's big blockbusters has already hit screens around the globe, and that would be Iron Man, which sees Robert Downey Jr. play the role of Tony Stark, the billionaire industrialist, who is a bit of an annoying shit, really, but soon sees the error of his ways when he's forced to fight his way out of a hostage situation, and then decides to... try and save the world from all types of evil people, as only sort of comic book characters could really do, being as that sort of thing doesn't happen in the real world. I was quite looking forward to Iron Man on the basis of the trailers. I thought that it may have hit just the right balance between sort of comic book action and tongue-in-cheek irony. But what say you, fellas?
Iron Man, being the first film from the new Marvel Studios brand, turns out to be pretty... fantastic, actually. You've been through enough of the plot here. I'm not actually going to bother mentioning it now I come to think of it, because it's the plot's largely irrelevant. The main story in this film is Robert Downey Jr., because he is simply extraordinary in this role. In short, I mean, this film is pretty much what you'd expect from an origin story of any character, but what sets it apart is the strong execution of this familiar formula, topped off by a blistering turn from Robert Downey Jr. It's no stretch to say that this film would be very ordinary indeed were he not present, and his delivery is pitch perfect, and he provides such a likeable human presence that he can largely carry through his characterization even after he dons a big metal helmet and turns into a hot rod Robocop. He's given more than adequate support from the rest of the cast, including Gwyneth Paltrow and Jeff Bridges. But for the most part, it's the Robert Downey Jr. show, and it's none the worst for it. He continues a streak of awesome performances from such delights as Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Zodiac and The Scanner Darkly, which, for those keeping track, are three of the best films this decade. And Iron Man hitches itself firmly to Rob's charisma wagon and steams off in the general direction of success. If you're going to nitpick, the final reel's maybe a little bit disappointing, reducing itself to a well-realised but largely soulless rendering demonstration with very little scope for the protagonist to show what's under the metal shells that are bouncing around. And this jars a little with how human the characters have been previously. Given that the other 95% of the film time bounces around between pretty good and excellent, I think we can forgive them this minor transgression. It does swing dangerously close to formula at some points, but formulas persist for a reason. They work. So Iron Man works, and if Batman Reboot 2, the rebootening, can match this, then we'll have a fairly decent summer in store. Very enjoyable film, very much liked it.
Were you in concurrence, Drew?
I was.
Excellent.
Very underwhelming.
Yes, it's very good indeed.
Well, that's a pleasant surprise.
It has the most amusing robot arms since Red Dwarf Scutters. again, once again, I find myself, Scott and I were almost completely in agreement on this film, so I haven't much to add to what he said. It's the Robert Downey Jr. show, but since Robert Downey Jr. is awesome, that's only
a
good thing.
He's done all right since he come off the funny stuff, hasn't he?
Yeah, I know. How he still has a career at all is one of those things that puzzles me endlessly. You imagine he must have burned all his bridges, but apparently
absolutely.
Not.
You would think he'd used up his reserve of goodwill, but there you go.
Yeah, a talent shines through, apparently. His talent has been rewarded, and it's very good because he's given some fabulous performances since, well, around about the time of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's, I mean, it's worth seeing, even if you're not a comic book movie fan, and I mean, I am, but since Spider-Man 2, I've been sick to death of them, even though there have been some good ones in the interim, in Batman Begins particularly. I was sick to death of them, I don't want to see any more. But even if you're not a comic book movie fan, it's worth seeing just because Robert Downey Jr. is so good.
And how effective is Jeff Bridges as the key douchebag?
That's the thing, that kind of disappointed me. I'm a big fan of Jeff Bridges, but I just don't think he had a lot to work with. He had some kind of really dodgy dialogue, very ropey dialogue in this.
Yeah.
It's like they spent all their time polishing up the Robert Downey Jr. character and didn't really have a lot of time left to work on him.
If there's anything, it's the same sort of thing you get in quite a lot of origin, well, certainly first superhero films, where the villain tends to get sort of shuffled off to the side, who'll actually deal with more of the character.
Well, they set up the good guy, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to bring out the comparison to the first Fantastic Four film, because it's just a completely different game, not even a different ballpark. But that had the same thing as well, where it just spent all this time setting up the heroes, and then sort of went, oh, and there's a villain as well, and sort of shoveled them in at the last second just to kind of parachute them in to give them something to do at the end. And it's never quite satisfactory. But that's the only... I mean, this is nitpicking, because it's still reasonably good in terms of that, and it certainly works well enough for the film to succeed.
Yeah, it's just unfortunately anything that Jeff Bridges could bring to it in terms of the climax anyway, certainly just it's lost, because it's just two big CGI things thumping crap out of each other, and it's never entertaining. And you know, at that point it's like kind of lose interest, which is so disappointing given how good the rest of it is. And it's, if anything, Jeff Bridges deserved probably more. Especially given that his characters are apparently an absolute genius who can make specialised tools simply for removing miniaturised arc reactors from people's chests.
Excellent.
Which is very, very specific tooling.
It's a key skill though, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Somewhat disappointing CGI robot thing, smashing CGI robot thing about the head for a climax. I mean, that's not spoiling it for anybody. You know that's coming. That so CGI things are going to do final battle. Other than that, it's just highly recommended.
See, the only thing I'll say about it is a lot of people will say, stay to the end of the credits, there's an awesome surprise.
No, there isn't.
To the end of the credits. Unless you are the world's biggest comic book geek, there is not a tremendous surprise. There's something that will at least make you go, oh, and walk out, having sat through about, what, 7.5 minutes of credits, yeah.
So there we go then, not off to a bad start for the summer blockbuster season. We'll hopefully be able to tell you in the next podcast how indie gets on. But in the meantime, we'll have a quick discussion about Persepolis, which is an account of the Iranian Revolution, as told through the eyes of a young girl called, is it Marianne? Marianne?
Marjan,
told in the medium of stark black and white stylized animation. I've got to admit that I'm quite keen to get round to checking this out because it's garnered fantastic reviews, and it missed out on best animated feature Oscar to, was it Ratatouille or something like that at the Oscars, which seemed to irk a lot of people. Were they right to be irked, or were they wrong?
No, they were wrong. Also, not that Ratatouille deserved it, but against a year of like nothing deserved any of the awards they got, bar Daniel Day-Lewis. They're wrong. It's really so, quite dull.
What is there that has given you cause for annoyance, Drew?
It's just dull. It's done as animation for no appreciably good reason, because the animation isn't particularly entertaining or artistic or
is
different.
It not? It's based on a graphic novel, isn't it, though, which is drawn in the, exactly this. Does it not mimic the style of the artwork from the graphic novel? But then what we're saying essentially there was no need for it to be a graphic novel to begin with, though.
It was a columnized diary from a newspaper, was it not?
Mm.
It's from the women's diaries anyway. But it's just, I don't know, I can't really eloquently put this. It's just, it's dull. You just like, this little bratty little girl has some stuff happen to her, but it would happen to her because she's not a particularly nice person. It ends. And it's, I don't want to say anything about it because I just simply did not care about the character at all. And it's got me to say something more worthwhile and useful about it yourself, because I just can't bring myself to say anything useful about it. Was dull.
As an animated film, it's got a style that owes more to Mr. Ben than Studio Ghibli. the tale of Marjane Satrapi, I believe, as she grows up in Iran and France, is, I suppose, there's very little point recapping someone else's life story. The film will do it better than I can, but I think the central criticism we've got of it is, why is this notable? It's the sort of film that if it had been done as a live-action film, people would have went, okay. And swiftly forgotten about. The fact that it's done in an animated form does not make it better.
And I also, so just to say what you're saying about if it'd been live action too, I suspect even if it'd been animated but in English, that it might have been overlooked as well. Mm. I kind of get the feeling that because it's animated and French, that it's getting more praise than it ought to. But perhaps I'm wrong about that, but I certainly feel that way.
I mean, I thought some of the early running where Marjane's families go through the hopeful days after overthrowing the Shah in Iran, before the crushing despair of coming under the control of hardline Muslim nutbags we come to know and love in this modern age, is sort of interesting. I kind of see where you're going from that, but then she moves off to France.
Austria, to actually.
Was it Austria? Oh,
yes,
yeah,
she was to Vienna at first.
Adolescent days in Vienna are significantly less interesting and really no different from anyone else in the rest of the world, and the film's only saved slightly by heading back to Iran in the final couple of reels. It's just not that great. I mean, having read a few interviews with Marjane in various press outlets, it's quite apparent that the misery that she feels has been heaped on her during adolescent times is pretty much her own fault, because she's prickly, irritating, supercilious, and frankly deserving of being made unhappy. I don't know, that's not really anything to do with the film, I suppose, but it explains some of it, I guess. Just the simple fact that this is animation rather than live action doesn't make it great, and there's time when it sails perilously close to being self-indulgent and just dull. It's more or less avoids them most of the time, and it sort of winds its way up being all right. But I've got to say, I mean, this is the sort of thing, but a Miyazaki film would teach you far more about the human condition with its fantastical creatures and fantastical settings and being a lot more entertaining than this, which is obviously a deeply personal story, but it's just not particularly interesting, engaging, involving, or informative.
You're given really no reason to care about the character at all. You pretty much, you're watching it thinking, there is a person, something is happening to this person. I don't care why, I'd like it to end now. Perhaps not quite to that extent, but you feel that there's no real reason to invest any emotion in the character at all.
Two things that I took away from this is, one, I'm glad I didn't grow up in Iran, and two, Oscar worthy? Huh?
Yeah, but most films that were nominated this year weren't, as we've discussed in several podcasts of late. But it's just, this is the one bit of emotion I invest in it was to do with the whole, it's Islam, it's just religion in general, which had me angry, which it generally does. It's like messing up people's lives. But I know that certain bits of it reminded me of The Kite Runner, a way of a totalitarian Islamic regime changing a country and making it considerably less free than it had been, but it did it in a considerably better manner. And then you actually, you know, the main character as an adult wasn't particularly likable. Certainly you had more emotion invested in the characters and cared more about them in that film than in this.
Out of interest, did The Kite Runner even get nominated for an Oscar?
I don't think it did.
I don't think it did. It got nominated for BAFTAs and things, but I thought that was a far better film than the bulk of the things that wound up being
It wasn't without its flaws. I mean, we discussed this in another podcast too, but certainly it was a lot better film than Persepolis, and there were such similar themes covered. Mm-hmm. It did far more effectively.
It's certainly better than Juno.
It was the only Oscar that The Kite Runner was nominated for was musical score.
That's something of a travesty, that. But, well, we've discussed that at various points in the past. The Oscars really aren't worth noticing anymore.
No.
Well, if nothing else, lads, you've completely snatched away my desire to see Persepolis. Thanks for that.
Welcome.
We're saving you time.
The one film I did. You know what's coming. The one film I did manage to catch, well, at least an hour of it, thanks to being called back into work for half an hour as I sauntered into the cinema, is latest offering from British director Neil Marshall, and that would be Doomsday. For those of you who may be having trouble putting a face to the name, he is the chap responsible for the excellent Dog Soldiers and the equally excellent Descent, both of which managed to provide thrills and spills in some great measure. Doomsday is set in, well, begins in contemporary Britain, where a horrendous virus called the Reaper virus devastates the population. In an act of completely sensible and understandable haste, the British government decide to rebuild Hadrian's Wall and block Scotland off from the rest of the country, thus containing the virus. However, 30 years later, the virus breaks out once again, and a team of soldiers is sent in with the remit to investigate the potential for a cure. Guys, I don't mind saying that I felt this was mildly disappointing, to say the least.
It's one of the silliest bloody things I've seen in ages.
It does star the original Lara Croft.
But, yeah, that's a great sign. That's a fantastic sign. What, Rhoda Mitra is in a film. Okay, let's not see that one.
No, let me give you two other signs which I would class as being slightly more off-putting than that. One would be Malcolm McDowell, and the other would be Bob Hoskins.
Yes, but Bob Hoskins in full-on cockney mode as well.
Yes, exactly. He clearly thinks he's just come back from the long Good Friday, and it's, oh dear, 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 dear. To say I was sorely disappointed would be at least there's an interesting comment on the IMD message boards here, which says, don't ever give Marshall a budget like this again. What budget? Did it have a budget?
It does have a budget. It's been splurged on things that are completely unnecessary.
Like huge stone courtyards for fights.
Yeah.
Well, if nothing else, look at that bit where they build up this wall, and you come back to the end, they built these sentry guards.
Yes.
Machine gun emplacements that are automated and shoot things. And they build these extravagant things only to have it shoot a bunny rabbit and then never be referred to ever again for the rest of the film. Why?
Why indeed?
What are you doing?
It manages a startling feat, actually, of presumably having a budget about 100 times that of The Descent, yet managing to look infinitely cheaper.
Yeah.
Or is that just me? It draws all sorts of comparisons, and quite blatantly, I mean, it wears its influences on its sleeve. It owes a huge debt to things like Escape from New York and the Mad Max films.
Mad Max versus Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, and if you want to make a low-budget sort of sci-fi action film, you can't really go to much better sources than those, to be honest with you. And a man of Marshall's talent should have been able to mine them for all the gold they were worth. But I think he's taken a huge misstep with this that felt very cheap in that way that makes you sort of embarrassed about sort of British film when it tries to do this sort of thing. It's not cheap in an inventive way, it's just cheap in a crap sort of plastic spacesuit way.
I'll forgive films for being silly if they have some sort of coherency within their own little world, but this
is just
stupid.
Dog Soldiers was completely stupid, wasn't it? But it was a great laugh. It managed to be as gung-ho as this clearly wants to be, but...
But this is just really stupid. I mean, this extravagant setup at the start saying, oh, our spy satellites have been trained in it and we've found one survivor wandering about. It's like, how shitty are your spy satellites? when you've missed an entire fucking subculture of hundreds upon hundreds of survivors running about wild. Yeah. It's like, oh, we didn't notice them. Yeah. Sorry, we weren't looking in that direction.
And trains and cars running.
Yes.
Apparently, all these people are dead. Nobody's seen them for Eddie's, but the one person who escapes from prison immediately finds a steam train sitting waiting for a running and ready to go.
As you do.
Convenient. This is like no thought has been applied to the film at all.
As Scotsman, of course, it would be easy to feel somewhat aggrieved at this sort of borderline racism which goes on. But to be honest, no one in the film comes off particularly well. I'd rather be one of the Mohican sort of sporting feral Scots running about what should be Glasgow, but was actually, I think, shot in South Africa.
In a nutshell, the film reduces to about 2 hours of Scotsmen slurring, "We're gonna eat ye."
Exactly.
Which, to be honest, I can get if I walk out the front door in the morning. It's not really, it was a terrifying effect that Marshall must have thought it would have. So instead you've got a fifth string action movie with over the top splatter effects, and if you want over the top splatter effects, go and watch Total Recall and you'll have a far better time.
No, if you want comedy gimps for no good reason and
the comedy gimps,
savages wearing kilts dancing the can-can, blokes that is wearing kilts dancing the can-can, then this is a film for you. But that's about 2 minutes out of the entire running time, after
it's
which
like
you
an expose on what we Scots really get up to in our spare time.
This film is dreadful. It's just this bunch of tenuously connected nonsense that I cannot countenance calling a plot, and staggers to an end, and
a really bizarre ending which got any care left at all. You're like, why'd she do that then?
There are so many unanswered questions left at the end. I would be really bothered by it if I hadn't used my car keys as a makeshift trepanning instrument, and I'd just like let my brain dribble out of my head by that point, because it's just so god awful.
Just can't get over the cheap look of it. I was, you know, the section where they're sort of driving about in the armoured vehicles and just shooting, just wailing on sort of random Scots people running in the door, sort of mindlessly charging them like lemmings. And they're wearing the sort of, the soldiers, this crack team of soldiers are wearing this sort of body armour. And it looks so poor that I just sit there and I think, do you know what? If a prop guy came up to me and said, look, this is what we'd come up with, I would say, look, just ditch the suits.
Well,
ditch the guns. Let's just stick with regular stuff.
If you started on that path, you would have ditched the guns, because they looked like something out of the Sega arcade game Ghost Squad.
Yeah, they look like something that's supposed to plug into a bloody blender as an attachment or something like that. I don't know. Some sort of crazy futuristic dustbuster.
Okay, we'll ditch that. We'll ditch the cars because they look stupid. We'll ditch this underground bunker, which is apparently sealed but has like exits at two ends so people could use it as a fucking shortcut.
It's a nuclear shelter, a fallout shelter that's open on one side.
It makes an awful lot of sense, doesn't it?
Really, what Marshall should have done is just taken his cameras up to Socky Hall Street for a Saturday night and just let them run for a couple of hours.
To be honest, it's far more scary.
Far more scary, far more lively, far funnier, and it would have cost a lot less.
And we're allowed to be racist about this because we are Scottish. And I mean, we could be saying that we're being harsh about this out of a sense of insulted national pride, but we don't have any left because we've made Devil's Gate. So
yeah, exactly. Oh no, we've had no pride for a long time. We're not down on this because of any sort of patriotism. But no, honestly, I can laugh at a stupid Scots accent as much as the next man. But this really is just. Neil Marshall, what have you done?
I've come across a user comment on the Time Out website here beneath the Doomsday Review, where the user states, "This was as good as Iron Man, though made on a fraction of the budget. The director has shown a surreal image of a doomed futuristic Glasgow, and the car chases were fun in themselves. This person is wrong and should probably be put out of his misery for the rest of the humanity's good." And the car chase is one of the points that bothered me so very much. And you could spend days, spend days picking flaws in this film.
If you started cataloguing them, you'd be here for the next week talking about them. So.
The car chases are not fun at all. They're quite ridiculous. Let's disregard the fact that for some reason what people would put in a nuclear fallout shelter is oodles of satellite phones and a £180,000 Bentley in a cargo container. We're then expected to believe that this said Bentley, 35 years later, is going to be outrun by 1970s rusty transit vans chopped in half, which is largely what the car chases come down to. Because apparently the only cars left are from the 1970s, including, for some reason, a Rover V1 police car, which catches up and charges down a Bentley. This is a film that believes that not only would a Rover V1 exist at all, that a Rover V1 police car was something that existed 60 years into the future from when they were around, and beat a Bentley. And I know it's probably not an important thing to get upset about, but it's just things like that. It's just such a glaringly stupid thing.
See, one of the few things I liked about this film was the fact that that bus, the battered bus that we're driving about, had a sign on it saying, "Oot a fucking service, eh?"
Apparently this film's budget was £17 million.
No.
Apparently,
I can only imagine most of that was spent on transporting things out to South Africa.
I'm so gutted by this film because I had a lot of respect for Neil Marshall, but frankly, this is a Uwe Boll film. This would be bad by his standards.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely.
Good grief, this is abysmal. This is a
House of the Dead's probably better than this.
Is Marshall's cinematic magpie routine now wearing a bit thin then, do you reckon? Has he overstepped it a bit here?
I think someone's given him more money than he knows what to do with, so he's just tried to spread it about a bit. Rather than doing one thing very well, he's tried to do a lot of things here. He's trying to do action, and he's trying to do horror, and you really can't... It's very difficult to do both of those, and there's very few films that have ever actually managed to do it, and I think maybe Alien and Aliens are the only ones that have.
Yeah.
And it's... He set himself up a very difficult goal, and he's missed spectacularly. If you wanted to spend this amount of money and go and do a really nice horror, I mean, if you could have done The Descent again with slightly better values on it, and I probably would have been happy with it. Could have done Dog Soldiers again with better production values, and I would have been very happy with it. But doing this mess, no.
His next project is interestingly apparently going to be a horror western. So you can start placing bets now on which films he's going to rip off. Pay homage to. with that one, be interesting to see if he can redeem himself with his next one, because it's certainly quite a steep drop in standard here compared to his last two efforts. But still, suppose 2 out of 3 ain't bad at all. So Neil, you're on probation. Don't fuck up again. Well, everybody, thanks for entertaining us, or allowing us to entertain you, hopefully, for another indeterminate period of time. Next time we join you, we will hopefully be talking about, amongst other things, the new Indiana Jones film, Outpost, Speed Racer, and, someone's going to have to watch Sex in the City. Who could that unfortunate soul be? So, yeah, thanks once again. As always, I've been Craig, and with me tonight, as always, were Scott.
Farewell, goodbye.
And Bernard Matthews' Cornish cousin, Drew.
What?
I don't know.
And Vanilla Ice's brother, Drew Tavendale.
I've just decided you're... That's what you are. You're Bernard Matthews' Cornish cousin. Beautiful. Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Nice one. We'll catch you guys later. Cheerio. Oh dear. This drink has no taste of lemon, yet for some reason it reminds me of lemon.